The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. Thanks for getting up this early to come hear this talk about Women, Race, Class, and Class, A History of Black Feminism. So how Akuna and I decided to break up the talk is, so I'm going to talk more so about the late 19th century and like black feminism, and then Akuna's going to take over for the 20th century. So before I actually get into the history of black feminism, I think it's important to give a concise definition about like what black feminism actually is. And for me, black feminism is the long political tradition of black women fighting against economic exploitation, racism, and sexism, and other forms of oppression. Black feminism is about black women exercising their fundamental right, or asserting their fundamental right to exist and their humanity in a society that has long rendered us invisible. This is an important starting point for talking about what black feminism is and why it exists, because I think there's a way in which it's a little bit too easy to make it seem as if black feminism came about as just a reaction to like the racism of white feminists and like the sexism of black men. So I think it's important to say, so black feminists do certainly challenge those things, but I think the starting point is like black women's self-determination and like self-definition. So again, to be sure, black women have indeed forcefully and rightfully challenged the blind spots and bigoted tendencies within feminism and black power, black liberation struggles. However, as black women were brutally ripped from their homelands and then subjected to centuries of racialized and gendered violence, it hardly took black women until the 1960s and 1970s to know that they were oppressed. So I want to, again, I'm gonna focus on the 19th century and a little bit of the earliest 20th century. So there's kind of like four points that I want to make in this early history of black feminism. So first, I want to talk about how black women's fight for black liberation played an important role in developing and sharpening their feminist consciousness. Second, I want to discuss the conflicts and the contentions between black women, black feminists, and some of the early white feminists. Third, I want to talk about the class and political differences amongst black feminists, because I think that there's a way, so there's some, like the broad definition that I gave earlier at the beginning of the talk, so it is black women. Black feminism is about black women fighting economic exploitation, racism, and sexism, but I think there's a way in which we can make it seem as if it's a uniform kind of political tradition, and I think it's important to draw out some of the differences that come up within black feminism. And last, I want to end by discussing how issues of sexuality played an important role in black women's organizing within this period, and I want to pay a special attention to black women's fights against sexual violence. So in her book, When and Where I Enter, Paula Giddings boldly asserts, quote, "All black women abolitionists were feminists. For black women, it was the issue of race that sparked their feminism," end quote. In the 1830s, there could probably be no better example of this than abolitionist, women's rights activist, and public lecturer Maria Stewart. As Angela Davis points out, when Maria Stewart was challenged about her right to deliver public lectures, she quickly responded, "Who cares if I'm a woman?" Stewart was the first American-born woman to give public lectures to audiences consisting of both men and women. And excuse me, prior to her public lectures, she actually wrote an article in 1827 demanding education for black women at a time when ideas about education for all women was actually unpopular. In 1832, black women continued making firsts as a group of free black women established the first female anti-slavery society in Salem, Massachusetts. In addition to abolition work, the female anti-slavery society supported schools for free blacks, assisted newly freed or runaway enslaved blacks, and opposed racial segregation and discrimination in the northern free states. In 1834, the society began to include white women and officially reorganized as the Salem Female Anti-Slavery Society. Eventually, the society was disbanded in 1866. So again, I think it's interesting to point out that, okay, in the so the women in the Female Anti-Slavery Society were supporting education, and like Maria Stewart, were supporting education. They were involved in other political movements, not just abolition. And it's also important, like, so they were established in 1832, and then like 2 years later, they decided to include white women. I think especially now, there's a way, in contemporary feminisms, there's a way in which we think that black women and black feminists and white feminists like can never come together to organize or for struggle. So I think that like it's important to show in this history, black women and white women have actually, you know, come together for different political struggles. And so, similar to their black female counterparts, white middle class women also gained their feminist consciousness through their involvement in abolition work. To understand the conflicts between white women and black women during the 19th century, it is important to understand white women's involvement in abolition work and how this work informed their understanding of the relationship between sexism and racism. So working class and middle class white women were both drawn into abolition work in the 1830s. However, even though working class women, white women, offered decisive support to the anti-slavery movement, it was middle class white women that became the most visible figures in the campaign. Because these women did not have to work for wages compared to the working class women, they had more free time to engage in anti-slavery campaigns. And as Angela Davis notes, it was through working in the anti-slavery movement that white middle upper class women learned to challenge male supremacy, and they also gained political experience within the movement that would help them effectively organize campaigns for women's rights. For instance, in 1833, only 4 women were invited to the founding convention of the American Anti-Slavery Society, one of these women being Lucretia Mott. None of the women, including Mott, were invited to sign the Declaration of Sentiments and Purposes. Davis makes the point that it's unclear whether or not women were explicitly excluded, or if the men just didn't think to ask them to sign. But either way, the sexist attitudes of the men in the movement kept them from recognizing women's vast involvement and role in the anti-slavery movement. So this is kind of ironic because in the same way that abolitionist men often relied on sexist ideas to exclude women from the abolitionist movement, or they failed to recognize women's involvement and contributions to the movement, a number of white women's rights activists treated black women in similar ways. For instance, at the Seneca Falls Convention, the first women's rights convention held in 1848. So like Angela Davis praises these women because they talk about how the institution for like bourgeois women is oppressive, and they fight, and they're talking about the importance of education and other things, you know, trying to advance women's equality. However, there was a glaring omission of not only the needs of white working class women, but there was also a glaring omission of black women's needs. And it's important because right alongside white women organizing against women's oppression, as I mentioned earlier, there was Maria Stewart and the black women in the Anti-Female Slavery Society who were doing like similar kinds of work. So it wouldn't have made sense to exclude them. And so when white feminists weren't actively or excluding black women from the movement, from anti-sexist work, they often relied on white supremacists or racism to actually bar black women from participating. So it's ironic that Frederick Douglass, his daughter, so of course Frederick Douglass, Angela Davis, and many others consider him like the foremost and most ardent male supporter of women's rights in the 19th century. So Frederick Douglass, his daughter was admitted to a girls' seminary school in Rochester in 1848, so the same year of the Seneca Falls Convention, but The white female principal of the school, who was herself an abolitionist, actually prohibited Douglas's daughter from attending the classes with white girls. So unfortunately, white women's involvement in abolition did not always translate into a broad anti-racist consciousness. And so, oh my God. Okay, so perhaps the most, Lord Jesus, perhaps the most egregious and racist offenses committed by white female abolitionists at the time were these ideas that they used racist and white supremacist ideas to actually advance their right to vote over those of black women and black men. For instance, Elizabeth Cady Stanton appealed to white supremacy when she announced her candidacy for a New York congressional seat in 1866. And she says this: "In view of the fact that the freedmen of the South and the millions of foreigners now crowding our shores, most of whom represent neither property, education, nor civilization, are all in the progress of events to be enfranchised, the best interests of the nation demand that we outweigh this incoming pauperism, ignorance, and degradation with the wealth, education, and refinement of the women of the Republic." And it's, I mean, she doesn't have to be explicit about it, but obviously she's talking about like white women of the Republic. And so, let me just, oh my Lord, okay. So let me skip down, and in 1867, so when white feminists or white suffragettes weren't actually appealing to white supremacist ideas themselves, they were collaborating with racist, like known white supremacists, and they did this under the guise of political expediency. Like if they didn't appeal to racist Democrats, then white women would not be able to get the right to vote. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony met with a Democrat. He was a known white supremacist, George Francis Train, during the 1867 campaign, their 1867 campaign in Kansas. And he offered to cover the expenses of their speaking tour. And his slogan was, "Women first and Negro last." Anthony argued that political expediency was the justification for throwing their black brothers and sisters under the bus. Boo. So even though Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, you know, appealed to and collaborated with white supremacists, it's not, again, it's just not all doom and gloom. So Angelina Grimke, and Angela Davis makes the point that she had one of the sharpest, most radical analysis of the intersection between sexism, racism, and capitalism. And so she says this of the Civil War. She says, "The war is not, as the South falsely pretends, a war of races, nor of sections, nor of political parties, but a war upon the working classes, whether white or black. In this war, the black man was the first victim, and the working man of whatever color was the next victim." And then she goes on to say that now it's not only against it's not against black men and working men, but it's also against anybody who's fighting for equality, who recognizes the connections between these struggles. So again, I think it's important. Something I want to stress is that there are times when black women and like white women, they have been like serious, like genuine allies. I think that's important to stress. And I'm actually going to, let me just give a brief little overview about these class differences between black women, amongst black women. And so this will dovetail into my next point about like sexuality and sexual assault. So middle class black reformers, they had this really kind of like contradictory way of viewing womanhood. So on the one hand, they recognize that because of the long tradition of black women being portrayed as hypersexual, what they did in turn was they sort of wrapped themselves or cloaked themselves in a politics of respectability. So they said, if black women have been, you know, viewed as hypersexual, then we're going to be chaste, we're going to be moral, and we're going to, you know, be good, upstanding women, quote unquote. And so even though that's problematic, it's different from the white supremacist ideas that at the time that said black women were just innately immoral. But so black middle class women were saying, these were the vices that black women and other black members of the black community have, they stem from the conditions that they were a part of, that they were in. So it was poverty, lack of education, and these kinds of things led to the led to black women's vices. But working class black women, and this is Paula Gittings, and actually Angela Davis has a good book called Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, and she talks about specifically how black working class folks and like black working class blues singers had a different kind of understanding of sexuality. So she talks about Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and how these black working class women were openly embracing their sexuality at a time when that, again, black women, middle class black women were trying to put on this cloak of respectability. And so now I'm going to end on this section. How much time do I have? Like zero?
15, but I think you should go.
Okay. Oh, good, because I was going to keep going, okay? I'm kidding. So, as getting notes, so I just mentioned the idea of this, the pervasive idea of like sexual violence and how that comes from, that's a controlling image that's still pervasive in society, but its roots are in slavery. And so, and this is where I think it's interesting to talk about the connection between sexuality and lynching. So we have to talk about Ida B. Wells. And then personally, I think the B stands for badass. as getting Paula Gettings notes, the idea of the sexually potent black man was largely based on ideas about the promiscuous black woman. The thinking went that in order to satisfy such a hot-natured woman, black men had to have sexual appetites on par with black women. Post-slavery, because black men were now outside of the constraints of their masters, they would now turn their sights onto white women. However, in her research, Ida Badass Wells found that only a third of the murdered blacks were even accused of rape, much less guilty of it. And however, she also made an important point. So while like white supremacists were arguing that black men were innately like rapists, no one was talking about the fact that black women, historically and at the time in the late 19th century, black women were actually being the targets of sexual violence. So she says, so this is Ida B. Wells. The rape of helpless Negro girls, which began in slavery days, still continues without reproof from church, state, or press. And so I think that that's like a really important sort of analysis. Again, I'm sure Akuna's going to talk about it in the contemporary period, but I think it's important to see the ways in which like Ida B. Wells and like the other women that I'm talking about have always had this sort of intersectional analysis where they understand that black women experience particular kinds, they experience a particular kind of racialized and gendered kind of oppression, right? And no one was talking about that, well, outside of black women. And so, and the last point that I want to make is the connection between the sexuality and like sexual violence and labor. There's, while both middle class and working class black women were deeply concerned about sexual violence, working class black women, specifically domestic workers, tied in their fights against sexual assault to labor struggles. As Davis notes, time after time, black domestic workers had to choose between being victims of extortion on the job, and they were forced to choose between sexual submission and absolute poverty for themselves and their families. For instance, one Georgia woman remarked that she lost her living job because, in her words, she refused to let the madam's husband kiss me, end quote. In 1919, when the Southern leaders of the National Association of Colored Women drew up their grievances, the conditions of domestic service service workers were first on their list. And so, you know, since slavery, again, the deplorable conditions of domestic workers actually nourished notions of the immorality of black women. This is Davis. Household work is considered degrading because it is disproportionately performed by black women, who are in turn viewed as inept and promiscuous. And so again, this is where we see the, you know, the intersection between, you know, labor and class and, you know, race and gender. So that's a really, really important point. And so I just want to wrap up by just reiterating the point that, again, thinking about the quote of like Angelina Grimke, like white women have not always been foes or, you know, white supremacists. Like there's times when black women, black feminists and white feminists have, in fact, you know, successfully worked together. And I think this last point about thinking about how this connects to the contemporary moment, the last point about sexual violence gets, so when you lay out this history, then you kind of understand, you begin to understand black women's response to slut walk. Does anyone remember the slut walk? And so there's open letters by black women, and they were writing that because of this long history of sexual violence, right, using the word slut, like these words are inherently racialized. So it's incumbent upon, you know, feminists, if we're gonna build, you know, an inclusive, you know, left, and you know, a feminist left, then we have to take into account this long history of black women's oppression and their fight against, you know, their particular kinds of intersecting oppressions if we actually want to build a working class fighting inclusive movement. And I'll just end there.
Yeah, as Nikita mentioned, I'm going to kind of start a little bit where she left off, starting from the latter part of the 20th century. In this tradition, and just wanted to highlight two points within that. One, I wanted to talk about specifically the contribution of black socialist feminists in this era, and some of the arguments and their activity that really shaped the black feminist politics. In two ways that I want to kind of draw out. One being intersectionality, which is something that Nikita really described, but isn't something that is termed or coined or whatever until the 1980s, but definitely discussed and theorized by some of the folks that I want to talk about. And it's a concept that's tries to understand the impact of these different oppressions and how they work simultaneously to support subordinate black women, race, gender, and class. I just want to talk about the specific contribution that these activists made in terms of that concept, and then also highlight how I think because these folks were focused on a larger movement for human liberation, also saw their role as, and I think this is also just a part of the black feminist tradition generally, as trying to argue within the movement. And so, you know, as Nikita mentioned, there's often a sense that black feminism is about separation, and there are literal times when groups separate to figure out what they, because of the racism and sexism in society at large and within movements. But I also want to try to highlight that I think that these folks also try to make an impact in the movements that they were a part of, especially the communist socialist left. So with that, I want to start with Claudia Jones, a Trinidadian Marxist who joined the Communist Party here in the U.S. In the 30s through the struggle around the Scottsboro Boys, which is this case, nine young black men who were falsely accused of raping two white women, and became sort of a focal anti-racist focal point for that generation of radicals. And what I wanted to kind of highlight is some of her arguments made in a really important essay. A highly influential essay called "An End to the Neglect of the Problems of the Negro Woman" with an exclamation point that she wrote in 1949. And this was an argument to the Communist Party, as well as the labor movement in general, about the actual the character of the militancy within within the black female working class, but also the need to actually look at the specific oppression of black women to understand that and to challenge those key aspects where she felt like there was a neglect of those aspects of black women's oppression in order to be able to really build, because this was a focus of the Communist Party, to actually build an anti-racist struggle and a black leadership. And to be able to do that, Claudia Jones argues we need to understand the actual their black women's oppression and how and their location within the within the current economic structure. So just a couple of things from that argument that she makes. She goes into just talking about how after the since slavery, black women being pushed. Well, let me start here. First, I think that one thing that was important, and just in terms of this description of intersectionality, is she talks about the Negro woman as woman and as workers as the most oppressed stratum of the working class, and then goes into like how that manifests itself at the time. Just kind of highlighting three, race, class, and gender. She also sort of terms this, I don't think in this essay, but later, a triple jeopardy oppression. So a kind of an earlier, I think, term for intersectionality. Or she talks about black women being sort of, marginalized since slavery being pushed, since after slavery, sorry, being pushed into domestic work and marginalized economically in terms of being put into a part of the labor force that is heavily underpaid and also the scene completely subordinate aspect of labor. Just stressing the maintenance of that that relationship, especially between white women and black women, of master and maid. Her argument is to kind of make pay attention to that, especially for folks in the Communist Party who may also have maids being more critical of what that means for the black female working class experience. But also, I think she talks about that their power, black women's power within the working class. So not only are they part of a domestic workers that's actually starting to organize their own unions, but also teachers, service sector, nursing, the process of going through the Second World War, where all women were sort of put into industrial jobs, and then afterwards taken out of them. She does talk about like a sort of sense of empowerment that process gave black women, she starts to describe how actually black women were part of leading some important strikes, especially. Sharecropper strikes, as I said, organizing within the domestic labor, trying to start a domestic labor union, where most of the labor movement thought that would be too difficult because it's too disparate. So her argument to the Communist Party and to the labor movement was to actually pay attention to that and also try to understand their black women's location within the economic structure of the time and where they have power to be able to actually develop win a black female working class leadership. This kind of argument had a influence with communists around her, especially folks like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a close comrade of hers, but also adopted a lot of her arguments about triple jeopardy oppression. It was very important. I think also laid the basis for arguments later that people tried to articulate around what's later called intersectionality. Hope that was clear. And then, so I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit to sort of the 70s, because I want to talk about two aspects that Angela Davis, in her book Women, Race, and Class, that she goes into, kind of two big arguments around sexual violence and reproductive justice that I think it's important to look at it at, the way, and especially the way that she looks at, because this is kind of a point in the feminist movement that people sort of look to as like the time where Black women are separate from the movement because of the debates around the racism in within the movement. So how she looks at that. First, I just kind of stepping back into the earlier 20th century, I thought one thing that was really important was that Angela Davis noted that it takes 4 decades of after the sort of the kind of rise of lynching in the late 19th century for there to be an organized response from white women. There's an organization that pops up in 1930, the Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching, that takes on the claim that lynching is about preserving the purity of white women, and vows to actually change all of Southern public opinion, which I think is huge. But that took I did the argument and the activity. Okay, the argument and the activity of folks like Ida B. Wells, but a struggle led by Black women for that to emerge. In the 70s, some of the same arguments crop up again, and Davis makes the point of saying that it's really unfortunate that some of the leading feminists of the time, some of the leading white feminists of the time, did not go back to their history on some of these questions. And it's just, I'll start with sexual violence and rape. I don't think I explained the myth of the Black rapist, the Black male rapist that goes along with its counterpart, the Black female promiscuous female that sort of was hanging over the ability of white of a multiracial fight back against lynching, still sort of weighed over the movement in the 70s. Davis makes a point that given the central role played by the fictional Black rapist, in the shaping of post-slavery racism, it's at best irresponsible theorizing to continue to represent Black men as the most frequent authors of sexual violence. And as an example of that, I just wanted to pick on one prominent feminist of the time, Susan Brown Miller, and her description of the activity around the Scottsboro case, which is a huge point of radicalization for Claudia Jones, but also a layer of Black feminists. A time where their leadership sort of came to the forefront. She argues that the left, Brown Miller, she argues that the left in this case championed symbols of racial injustice, creating bewildered heroes out of the 9 young men, who to her were just pathetic, semi-literate fellows who wanted nothing more than to beat the rap that they were facing. And meanwhile, the women who falsely accused them were merely confused. So she's writing about this at a time where there's a movement around sexual violence within the feminist movement. As Davis argues, it's her failure to alert white women to the urgency of combining a fierce challenge to racism with a necessary battle against sexism is an important plus for the forces of racism today. So it's a missed opportunity to take on sexual violence with a united movement. Just another example, and what that meant in a similar way as that it took 4 decades for there actually to be an organized response from white feminists around lynching. The case of Joanne Little in 1975 was a woman who was in prison, raped by a white prison guard, and in self-defense kills the guard. And there was a huge response from Black organizations for her acquittal. Immediately following that, there's a campaign for Delbert Tibbs, a man on death row who was falsely accused of raping a white woman. So there's an immediate connection amongst Black organizations that Davis describes took a while for some white organizations to actually jump onto because of the accusation of rape. So the, again, just the missed opportunity of not looking back to the history and the arguments made by Black feminists.
I think I just want to, because I don't want to belabor the point, I also want to
say another thing about the way Davis argues around this that I think is really important. The important question of class, of considering class and race in these discussions around sexual violence. And just in terms of rape, she talks about the focus in the 70s around the accused, which automatically skews the conversation to looking only at Black men. Skews the conversation to only looking at Black men, but also misses the fact that Black women are the victims of largely the victims of rape as well, especially in relations in power dynamics in terms of like white male bosses. So she brings in the question of class, and I think one thing that she talks about that's really helpful is that in the late 70s there is a recession and an economic crisis in which the ruling class tries to reassert itself, and part of that means facilitating racism, sexism, and different forms of oppression, and literally reasserting its economic dominance through the use of oppression. And she argues that missing that that complex situation actually means that you're not getting at the social context for why rape and sexual violence is so pervasive. And I think these are actually ways that we want to start to look at that question today as well. So 15 minutes. So then I just kind of want to wrap up with the Combahee River Collective that comes out of Boston. I was rereading. So the Combahee River Collective was a group of women that came together in 1974, coming out of, they're veterans of the Black Power movement and also the feminist movement. And coming together to also sort of hone in on this concept of intersectionality in the context of movements that haven't, where they've seen racism within the feminist mainstream feminist movement and sexism within the Black Power movement. And I think what's interesting to look at with them is that I think you can read their statements and sort of see some of what we you know, is part of the discussion around, I think, around feminism, Black feminism today, that they chose to separate from the movement. But actually, I think that while they did separate, I think that their analysis was an attempt, what they did was an attempt to actually put back into the movement some important analysis that was bringing together race, class, gender, and sexuality as well. I want to read one of their, they have so many quotes that I want to read. So they do describe having to, when they talk about why they separated, they talk about the reactionary forces both outside and within the movement that serve to obscure their participation in the movement that they wanted to sort of hone in on in separating. And they talk about some of the other Black female organizations, the National Black Feminist Organization, that attempts to do the same. But they also argue in terms of, especially around their politics that they're formulating around what they call heterosexism, homophobia, and why they don't call themselves separatists. They say that we feel solidarity with progressive Black men and do not advocate the fractionalization that white women who are separatists demand. Our situation as Black people necessitates that we have solidarity around the fact of race. Yeah, we struggle together with Black men against racism, while we also struggle with Black men about sexism. So I think that this is an important aspect of the tradition as well, is actually like putting that back into the movement. I want to kind of end on what they talk about, and when they're considering themselves as socialists. These are women who, like I said, veterans of the Black Power struggle, feminist struggle, but are also very much a part of the movements of the day, going to a feminist socialist conference at the time to deepen their understanding of Black women's economic position, as they describe it, and this is why they say that they are socialists as well as Black feminists. We have arrived at the necessity for developing an understanding of class relationships that takes into account the specific class position of Black women who are generally marginal in the labor force. While at this particular time, some of us are temporarily viewed as desirable tokens at white-collar professional levels. We need to articulate the real class situation of persons who are not merely raceless, sexless workers, but for whom racial and sexual oppression are significant determinants in their working economic lives. Although we are in essential agreement with Marx's theory, as it is applied to the very specific economic relationships he analyzed, we know that his analysis must be extended further in order for us to understand our specific economic situation as Black women. I wanted to read all of that because I think that's important in terms of why there's the need to actually be a part of a larger radicalization and make some of these arguments that they were making about the specific oppression of Black women. I think for them they saw and also just to kind of highlight like the compatibility within a Marxist analysis that starts out with looking at the world through looking at the economic exploitation that's at the center of all the crap that we're trying to fight. I think seeing a larger picture, a larger movement for human liberation, but also the necessity of us looking at, analyzing, and challenging the specific oppression, I think, is also compatible with Marxists like Claudia Jones, who are trying to sort of argue that within a socialist left. And I think that that's an important legacy that these Black feminist socialists have left. I just want to leave it there for discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.